Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 609, Update on Germany. This is being recorded on September 2nd of the year 2007. Before we launch into the main body of the broadcast, please use the websites that are available, in particular the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. It is I would go so far as to say the Spitfire website and its linked websites are the best individual online research resource for this type of material available. So please use it. Each program is a long article-length description, often with material I did not have time to fit in the original broadcast. There's an entire mini-library of old anti-fascist books available, and numerous other resources that are available. And, of course, WFMU has been archiving the For the Record shows for many years. They're podcasting the program, so please use the online resources. In particular, people who are new to the program may have a difficult time getting located in it. Use the online resources. Now, we're going to be updating matters German, and we're going to begin the first two articles. We're going to deal with a manifestation in Germany of things that are getting more press and more focus elsewhere. First of all, there has obviously been a great deal of trepidation, justified, in my opinion, over the volatile credit markets that have basically stemmed from the subprime crisis. I suspect that the threat to the international financial system and global economy is worse than we've been told. One of the reasons is that there are articles we don't hear a whole lot about in the U.S. but are elsewhere, like this one from the Financial Times of Tuesday, August 28th of 2007, an article by Richard Milne in Frankfurt headlined, German Banks Remain Silent. German banks, locked in a crisis over the fallout from volatile credit markets, have adopted a curious strategy over their increasing image problem. Silence. After the head of a regional bank warned that the situation of German banks was critical, as some foreign banks were refusing to lend to them, top executives at other financial institutions have decided to gag themselves. Quote, given the situation of the financial markets, the main commercial banks have decided to refrain from commenting in public on the general market situation, unquote, said an email from the head of communications at Dresdner Bank to journalists to explain why its chief executive was canceling a meeting. The Association of German Banks, the BDB, which represents the main commercial institutions, was keen to underline that there was no formal ban on executives speaking out, but an official said, quote, the banks have said they don't want to cause any more uncertainty by speaking out, unquote. Many financial executives were dismayed by the reaction to comments by Alexander Stuhlmann, chief executive of West Landesbank, warning that German banks were having difficulties getting credit from foreign institutions. That was a complete mess up, said one senior executive. Other actors in the German financial system are also keeping their own counsel, despite coming under severe pressure to justify their actions. The Bundesbank, the central bank, has said very little since its head called a state-led bailout of one bank an isolated, unquote, incident in mid-August, only for the rescue of another bank to be necessary days later. Likewise, BaFin, the financial regulator, has said little, despite criticism of its handling of the situation. Some German executives complain that this reluctance to speak out hurts the country and its image. Well, it certainly, if I were in any way invested in a German bank or in a position to have my welfare and fortune determined by the actions or inactions of that bank, I sure as bloody hell would be scared. And given the interconnected nature of the world's financial system, I don't feel very good about it here. I mean, if they're not saying anything for fear of scaring people, that's in and of itself about as scary as anything anybody would want. In a related article right next to that on the very same page of the Financial Times, Watchdog Faces Berlin Inquiry on Banks Bailout. It's by Bertrand Benoit in Berlin and Ivar Simonsen in Frankfurt. Reads in part, the German government will launch an inquiry into BaFin, the German financial services regulator, amid accusations that the watchdog took too long to address crises at two banks that had to be bailed out. Torsten Ulbig, a spokesman for the finance ministry which oversees BaFin, said yesterday the ministry would look into, quote, what reasons BaFin had to take or not take action, unquote. And so things aren't looking real good in Germany vis-a-vis the banks. Is that where the formal meltdown will start? I don't know, but their silence is not something I find particularly reassuring at all. There has been a lot of discussion, and for the most part justified, about some of the abuses of civil liberties, human rights, etc., that have been produced by the most improperly prosecuted war on terror. We should add parenthetically, one of the many sad things about the abuses at places like Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib is that they not only inflame the opposition, but they discredit what's left of the United States. And there is a very real war going on. It's an extension of World War II, and the multinational corporations and the underground Reich and the petroleum industry are using Islamists, or Islamo-fascists as some call them, a very real and valid term, as their foot soldiers. Germany ran out of troops and Italy ran out of troops, but there are plenty of Muslims around, and a lot of them are now of fascist persuasion, and indeed the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist organization whose economic doctrine is corporatist, is basically Al-Qaeda and Hamas, among other organizations, are outgrowths of that. While people, though, have been correctly citing many of the abuses that the United States has and other countries have engaged in, very stupid abuses, useless from a counterintelligence standpoint and very counterproductive from a PR standpoint, very, very quietly, under the auspices of the, quote, war on terror, unquote, Germany has been using that as a vehicle for basically establishing formal legal hegemony over all of Europe. Basically, all European law enforcement procedure and databasing is to be available for the Germans for their own use, regardless of the sentiments of the ostensibly sovereign nations to whom those databases and procedures belong. And at the same time as Germany is attempting to get all of the EU basically to sanction German law enforcement hegemony, German judicial hegemony and police hegemony over all of Europe, they also are claiming exceptionalism with regard to German policy towards immigrants from other countries. And in particular, the Germans are getting very upset over immigration from Eastern Europe and from places in the Third World. Of course, a lot of those immigrants are coming there because Germans have not, they don't have enough people to actually do much of their labor. But very quietly, this is receiving no publicity. The Germany is basically demanding complete police and judicial hegemony over all of Europe and are achieving that at the same time as they are absolutely demanding that they be accepted from EU policy on immigrants in general. And indeed, the Germans have been forming separate treaties about the repatriation of immigrants with some truly brutal nations in Europe. I would note, too, that in Germany's attempts, apparently so far at least largely successful at achieving complete judicial and police hegemony over Europe, they are being assisted in this regard by Austria, Spain, and Luxembourg. Of course, Austria was part of the Third Reich. Spain was a fascist country that collaborated with the Nazis, and Luxembourg was basically a Nazi money laundering center before, during, and after World War II. For our information about German attempts at establishing judicial and police hegemony over Europe, we're going to turn to the website germanforeignpolicy.com. And in an initial article from January 17th of this year, 2007, Dateline Dresden, entitled European Achievement, we read, "In spite of the massive resistance put up by several EU member states, the German Interior Ministry is demanding that a restriction on rights of national sovereignty in the field of national security be applied throughout the EU. Following a meeting with his EU counterparts, Wolfgang Schäuble announced that Germany intends to obtain access to police data of all EU member states. Berlin can already take sovereign action in some of its neighboring states. The legal basis for this was provided by the Prüm Treaty, P-R-U umlaut M, signed 2 years ago by a group of EU pioneers. Using its EU Council presidency, Berlin is planning to initiate the incorporation of the Prüm Treaty into the EU's legal framework. The treaty has come under criticism in Germany itself because of deficits in the protection of data privacy and its lack of democratic control. The attempt to subvert legitimate resistance in other countries through reaching a special agreement with some of the member states is being described in the German press as, quote, a novelty in the European integration process, unquote. It is being voiced that this is the opening possibility of enforcing numerous legal norms in spite of their far-reaching consequences without ratification by the entire EU. Because of its dominating position, Germany can set its own norms. Berlin has successfully rejected Portugal's plan to adopt the admirable migration policy model legislation. More about Germany's immigration policy later on. Continuing, the Prüm Treaty was signed by the Interior and Justice Ministers of the seven core European states on May 27, 2005, but has been ratified for the time being only by Germany, Luxembourg, Austria, and Spain. For the participating states, the treaty provides access to DNA and fingerprint databases as well as vehicle registration data. This access is available for purposes of prosecution or for preventive measures. An exchange of information on violent offenders and terror suspects, both very elastic terms, is already in progress. The Prüm Treaty also authorizes police operations on foreign territory. The German Interior Ministry calls this a revolutionary, unquote, treaty because it curtails sovereign rights in the field of security. Internationally, it is considered unique and derives from the initiative made by the former Minister of the Interior, Otto Schily, of the SPD. Berlin has always sought to extend the Prüm Treaty to cover the entire EU. According to the German Ministry of Justice, the contracting partner's goal is to convince as many European states as possible to join this pro-Europe treaty, unquote. The initial plan was to evaluate the treaty's effects and, after 3 years at the most, unquote, to initiate the incorporation of the terms of the Prüm Treaty into the EU legal framework. In great haste, the German Interior Ministry has already taken this initiative, even though this treaty has been only enacted in two countries, Germany and Austria, effective for about 6 weeks. And, of course, Germany and Austria, that is the old Reich. Continuing, at the recent meeting of the EU's Interior and Justice Ministers, he tabled this plan for discussion. Even though this treaty is heavily contested not only by several European states but also in Germany, its EU-wide adoption will be formally examined under German EU Council presidency at the next Interior and Justice Ministers meeting scheduled for February 15th and 16th in Brussels. Gisela Pilz, the FDP parliamentary group's domestic policy spokeswoman in the German Bundestag, criticizes that the Prüm Treaty reduces democratic controls over the security apparatus. Parenthetically, Dave would say not only is that true, but I suspect that's exactly the intent. Continuing, police forces intervening on foreign territory are not subordinate to the sovereign representatives of that nation. Quote, only reference to the EU Council's recommendations from 1987, which are explicitly non-binding, serve as a minimum standard for the data privacy laws, according to a privacy expert. Even if deficiencies should be discovered, there is no way to prevent the exchange of data from taking place once the treaty is enacted. The intended application throughout the EU has also come under massive protest. It is expected that this international treaty, elaborated and signed by the executives, will at best be slipped through national parliaments without debate and have supervision renounced by the European Parliament. Great Britain, Ireland, Poland, and the Czech Republic have until now strictly refused to join this treaty. The German government, while praising restrictions on rights of national sovereignty in the field of security as a European achievement, unquote, continues nevertheless to resist EU migration policy for Germany. German Interior Minister Wolfgang Schäuble brusquely rejected Portugal's initiative to introduce the green card procedure throughout the EU. Schäuble wants to be in charge of restricting immigration to Germany and a limited entry into the EU only on the basis of quotas of labor contingents from impoverished countries on the demand of businesses. An additional objective of the German EU Council presidency is the elaboration of the defense against refugees and the further reinforcement of the Frontex agency to seal off not only the southern, but also the eastern EU borders against unsolicited immigration. And who are the Germans collaborating with in their immigration policy? Listen to this. To facilitate the deportation of migrants, Berlin is hoping to conclude during its EU Council presidency so-called partnership treaties containing clauses regulating the evacuation of refugees with African third-party countries. According to Berlin, Mauritania, Mali, and Senegal are countries being considered as models for such treaties. By the way, I would note that as of a decade or two ago, Mauritania was the one country in the world that still had legal slavery. I don't know if that's been changed since. So that's not the best of legal precedents here. Beginning again, according to Berlin, Mauritania, Mali, and Senegal are countries being considered as models for such treaties. It is known that Mauritanian security forces have abandoned refugees deported from the EU in the desert. Mauritania is not the only West African country known for exceptional, unquote, treatment of refugees. Gambia, which likewise is presided over by a president brought to power through a putsch, is reported to have taken last fall 50 illegal immigrants from various West African countries, quote, as soon as they crossed the border from Senegal into Gambia. They were arrested and brought to the Marine headquarters in the Gambian capital of Banjul. Tied with cords and electric cable, they were transported by the military to different locations on the outskirts of Banjul, where they were executed, some with machetes, unquote. It is with Gambia, of all countries, that Germany intends to conclude its fourth model treaty, including regulations for deportation. Or, some might say, business as usual for Germany. The text, The Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, that I used to discuss not only the German flight capital program and the economic foundations of the Underground Reich, but also the political operations to an extent of an Underground Reich itself. Literally, a Third Reich gone underground in mafia style and perpetuated in mafia style, drawing in part at least on the profound multinational corporate connections, including connections to American transnational corporations, which helped to birth Nazism in the first place. There has not been a great deal of journalistic support for the Manning text. Various books have come out supporting part of it, but a few years ago, a book came out that presented a large amount of documentation for Paul Manning's allegations, and specifically this talks about the laundering of money through Argentina by the Nazis, then back to Germany in order to effect the German, quote, economic miracle, unquote. This is from the New York Times of April 4th of 2005. It's an article by Larry Roeter, R-O-H-T-E-R, titled Half Century Later, A New Look at Argentine Nazi Ties. Its Dateline Buenos Aires and reads that scores of fugitive Nazis found their way to Argentina after World War II, aided and abetted by General Juan D. Perón, is no secret. But according to a book just published here that draws extensively on archival material only now being made available to researchers, his government also offered a haven for the profits of German companies that had been part of the Nazi war machine and whose assets the victorious Allies would otherwise have seized. In The German Connection, The Laundering of Nazi Money in Argentina, Gabi Weber, a German journalist, argues that the Perón dictatorship sponsored an operation to move illicitly obtained wealth to Argentina and then back to Germany. For nearly a decade, her book asserts, German-made cars, trucks, buses, and even the machinery for entire factories flowed into Argentina, paid for with dollars that were then used to help finance the German economic miracle, unquote. To the chagrin of Argentines who still revere him and his wife Evita, the evidence she presents indicates that Perón and a few favorites around him also took a cut. But Ms. Weber, who has worked and lived in South America since the mid-1980s, said she was mainly interested in what she described as two parallel but complementary money streams to and from Germany, which were involved in and benefited from the arrangement. Quote, one must make a distinction between the Nazi Party organization and the companies which had no interest in financing a Nazi resurgence, unquote, she said in a recent interview here. Quote, my focus is on the official Argentine government operation to help those companies launder their money, but a lot of Nazis also did it on their own, hoping to reconstruct the party, unquote, from their hiding place here. Ms. Weber's book, published in German and Spanish, is based in part on research in the corporate archives of Mercedes-Benz and on interviews with Argentines and Germans who took part in the scheme. But she also consulted government records of Germany, the United States, and particularly Argentina, where she found transcripts of interrogations of participants after Perón's ouster in September of 1955, and other official documents that until now were generally off-limits to researchers. According to the documents Ms. Weber cites, the laundering operation involved both the consistent overcharging for goods exported from Germany to Argentina and billing for non-existent transactions. But the Argentine Central Bank also cooperated by permitting transactions to be conducted at an exchange rate unusually favorable to German companies. The German connection, unquote, focuses largely on Mercedes-Benz, the automobile, bus, and truck manufacturer that is today a unit of Daimler-Chrysler. But others offered by Ms. Weber as beneficiaries of the plan include German makers of electrical and railway equipment and other capital goods, as well as producers of items as varied as tractors and television sets. Quote, "It's impossible to calculate the exact amount of money laundered in Argentina between 1950 and 55," Ms. Weber said, "but it probably corresponds to well over $1 billion, unquote. According to Argentine documents seized after the overthrow of Perón, about half of one large shipment of Mercedes sedans to Argentina went directly to the president's office. Perón appears to have kept four cars for himself, but sent the others to judges and prosecutors, politicians, journalists, and others whose support he was seeking. Ms. Weber also found documentary evidence that in at least a couple of cases, entire factories were shipped to Argentina for reassembly here. Perón envisioned Argentina as an industrial power and apparently saw the importing of German equipment and experts as the best way to jumpstart aircraft, chemical, and other industries. Most of the machinery came from Rotterdam, although we don't know how it got there," unquote, Ms. Weber said. She added that most of the equipment appeared to be German in origin, although some were probably looted from Czechoslovakia or other conquered East European nations. At one point, Ms. Weber also maintains, the Nazi Adolf Eichmann was hired initially under his own name, but later under an alias, at the Mercedes-Benz plant in the suburbs of the capital. In the interview, she suggested that Mr. Eichmann, abducted by Israel in 1960 and then tried and executed, might have functioned as a sort of paymaster, financing the movement and flight to Argentina, unquote, of other fugitive Nazis. Skipping down. The publication of Ms. Weber's book follows the release here late last year of a documentary film that caused debate on the same subject. The film, Nazi Gold in Argentina, contends that Swiss banks, the Roman Catholic Church, and Argentine politicians conspired to loot hundreds of millions of dollars in cash and other valuable assets held by the Third Reich. The film includes scenes of Nazi submarines filled with gold bars unloading their treasure on the deserted beaches of Patagonia, events that many experts dismiss as fanciful, but it also sheds light on the activities of shadowy figures like Hermann Dörge, a German banker who worked in Argentina's central bank during the 1940s and was officially declared to have committed suicide after destroying the evidence of Nazi money transfers. In his book, The Real Odessa, Smuggling the Nazis to Perón's Argentina, the Argentine writer Uki Gonai documented how Croatian fascists allied with the Nazis shipped over 500 pounds of gold bars to Argentina after World War II. But he said that regarding German or Austrian Nazi money after the war, the trail is more diffuse, unquote. During the war itself, there is quite a lot of American documentation about how the Nazis laundered money, seized from the banks of conquered countries in Argentina so they could buy raw supplies, Mr. Goni said in an interview. He added that he found it, quote, fishy, unquote, that many Argentine central bank records from then and the post-war period were either incomplete or said to be destroyed. Quote, "I'm sure something happened, but the documents are still hidden," Mr. Goni said. "A tremendous amount of research still needs to be done, and the Argentine government needs to open up more records, especially those of state intelligence." Well, Martin Bormann himself was banking under his own name and also held a joint account with Argentine dictator Juan Perón from 1941 on. Read the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, available for download for free on the Spitfire website, and that goes into that. One of the very first acts we've examined Germany holding sway over the rest of the EU, demanding that the rest of the European Union subjugate its judicial and police procedures to German procedure, and yet demanding, too, that Germany be accepted from EU procedures on migration, and hooking up with truly brutal countries in Africa as model treaties on those policies. The very first act of the reunified Germany was to precipitate the first major land war in Europe, the Balkans War since World War II, by basically holding all of the EU prisoner until they recognized the secession of Croatia and Slovenia. And indeed, in the Hans Seidel Stiftung, as discussed by Martin A. Lee in his landmark text, The Beast Reawakens, was actively engaged in the destabilization of both Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia well before the end of the Cold War. And by forcing the rest of the EU to support the secession of Slovenia and Croatia, Germany obliged the lighting of the tinderbox, that is the Balkans, with predictable results. We're going to wind up this broadcast with a very short article showing how seeds that are planted can once again raise some very unsavory crops. Because once again, the Ustashi, the brutal Croatian fascists, are strutting their stuff openly in Croatia. Following article from the New York Times of Monday, July 2nd of 2007, it's from Zagreb, Croatia, June 30th. It's by Nicholas Wood. Fascist overtones from blithely oblivious rock fans. On a hot Sunday evening in June, thousands of fans in a packed stadium here in the Croatian capital gave a Nazi salute as the rock star Marko Perković shouted a well-known slogan from World War II. Some of the fans were wearing the black caps of Croatia's infamous Nazi puppet Ustaše government, which was responsible for sending tens of thousands of Serbs, Gypsies, and Jews to their deaths in concentration camps. Closer, actually, according to most statistics, the better part of a million, but then that's the New York Times here. Continuing, the exchange with the audience is a routine part of Mr. Perković's act, and the gesture seemed to lack any conscious political overtones. But Mr. Perković's recent success among a new generation, many of them apparently oblivious to the history of the Holocaust, has prompted concern and condemnation from Jewish groups abroad and minority groups in Croatia. So indeed, the past is never dead and buried. A lot of people can be dead and buried, and God knows a lot of them are in the former Yugoslavia, but the Ustaši are now strutting their stuff and at rock concerts. Young Croatians are giving the Ustaši salute and chanting Ustaši slogans and dressing like Ustaši. Wonderful. Just wonderful. Many of the things that I've spoken about on this broadcast, as is routinely the case on For the Record, will be better understood if you take advantage of the www.spitfirelist.com website that is available and utilize a tremendous amount of material that's available on that website. If you want to find out, for example, many people write to me, email me, and say, you know, do you have any information about this? Well, there's a search function on the Spitfire website. Use the search function. That'll answer many of the questions that I get asked. And please be aware that WFMU is archiving the entire For the Record series on Real Audio and also podcasting For the Record as well. So for background on the Balkans War, background on Martin Lee's books, background on the Manning text or the Manning text itself, and the many, many authors whose works I access on this program, please utilize the SpitfireList.com website and the many, many linked websites. There also, by the way, is a page on the Spitfire website to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what you're hearing, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes For the Record program number 609, Update on Germany, being recorded on September 2nd of the year 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.